In October, the men and women of Sorrento harvest the primo fiore, or first flowering fruit, the most succulent lemons. In March, the yellow bianchetti ripen, or however you say that word, sorry, Mary, followed in June by the green verdelli. In every season, you can find me sitting at my bench watching them fall. Only one or two lemons tumble from the branches each hour, but I've been sitting here so long, their falls seem contiguous, close as raindrops. My wife has no patience for this sort of meditation. "Jesus Christ, Clyde," she says, "you need a hobby." Most people mistake me for a small, kindly no-no, an Italian grandfather. I have an old no-no's coloring, the dark walnut stain peculiar to Italians, a tan that won't fade until I die, which I never will. I wear a neat periwinkle shirt, a canvas sun hat, black suspenders that sag at my chest. My loafers are battered, but always polished. The few visitors to the Lemon Grove who notice me smile blankly into my raisin face and catch the whiff of some sort of tragedy. They whisper that I'm a widower or an old man who has survived his children. They never guess that I'm a vampire. Santa Francesca's Lemon Grove, where I spend my days and nights, was part of a Jesuit convent in the 1800s. Today, it's privately owned by the Alberti family. The prices are excessive, and the locals know to buy their lemons elsewhere. In summers, a teenage girl named Fila mans a wooden stall at the back of the grove. She's painfully thin, with heavy black bangs, and I can tell by the careful way she saves the best lemons for me, kicking them under my bench, that the girl knows I am a monster. Sometimes she'll smile vacantly in my direction, but she never gives me any trouble, and because of her benevolent indifference to me, I feel a swell of love for the girl. Fila makes the lemonade and monitors the hot dog machine, watching the meat rotate on wire spigots. I am fascinated by this machine. The Italian name for it translates as carousel of beef. Who would have guessed at such a device 200 years ago? Back then, we were all preoccupied with visions of apocalypse. Santa Francesca, the foundress of this very grove, gouged out her eyes while dictating premonitions of fire. What a shame, I often think, that Santa Francesca foresaw only the end times, never hot dogs. A sign posted just outside the grove reads, "Sigaret pie, heat dogs, granite drinks, Santa Francesca's limonata, the most refreshing drink on the planet." Every day, tourists from Wales and Germany and America are ferried over from cruise ships to the base of these cliffs. They ride the funicular up here to visit the grove, to eat heat dogs with speckly brown mustard and sip lemon ices. They snap photographs of the Alberti brothers, Benny and Luciano, teenage twins who cling to the tree's wooden supports and make a grudging show of harvesting lemons, who spear each other with trowels and refer to the tourist women as vaginas in Italian slang. "Buona sera, vaginas," they cry from the trees. I think these tourists are getting much stupider. None of them speak Italian anymore. The new women seem deaf to aggression. Often I fantasize about flashing my fangs at the brothers just to keep them in line. As I said, the tourists usually ignore me. I believe it's the dominoes. A few years back, I bought a battered red set from Benny, a prop piece, and this makes me invisible, sufficiently banal to be hidden in plain sight. I have no real interest in this stupid game. Mostly I stack the pieces into little houses and corrals. At sunset, the tourists all begin to shout, "Look up there. It's time for the path of I pipistrelli impaziti, the descent of the bats." They flow from cliffs that glow like pale chalk, expelled from caves in the seeming billions. Their drop is steep and vertical, a black hail. Sometimes a change in weather sucks a bat beyond the lemon trees and into the turquoise sea. It's 300 feet to the lemon grove, 600 feet to the churning foam of the Tyrrhenian. At the precipice, they soar upward and crash around the green tops of the trees. "Oh," the tourists shriek, delighted, ducking their heads. Up close, the bat's spread wings are alien membranes, fragile like something internal flipped out. The waning sun washes their bodies a dusky red. They have wrinkled black faces, these bats, tiny like gargoyles or angry grandfathers. They have teeth like mine. Tonight, one of the tourists, a Texas lady with a big strawberry red updo, has successfully captured a bat in her hair, simultaneously crying real tears and howling, "Take the goddamn picture, Sarah." I stare ahead at a fixed point above the trees and light a cigarette. My bent spine goes rigid. Mortal terror always trips some old wire that leaves me sad and irritable. It will be whole minutes now before everybody stops screaming. The moon is a muted shade of orange. Twin disks of light burn in the sky and the sea. I scan the darker indents in the skyline, the cloudless spots that I know to be caves. I check my watch again. It's 8 o'clock. All the bats have disappeared into the interior branches. Where is my wife? My fangs are throbbing, but I won't start without her. I once pictured time as a black magnifying glass and myself as a microscopic, flightless insect trapped in that circle of night. But then my wife came along and eternity ceased to frighten me. Suddenly, each moment followed its antecedent in a neat chain, moments we filled with each other. I watch a single bat falling from the cliffs, dropping like a stone, head first, motionless, dizzying to witness. Pull up. I close my eyes. I press my palms flat against the picnic table and tense the muscles of my neck. Pull up. I tense until my temples pulse, until little black and red stars flutter behind my eyelids. You can look now. My wife is sitting on the bench, blinking her bright pumpkin eyes. You aren't even watching. If you saw me coming down, you'd know that you have nothing to worry about. I try to smile at her and find I can't. My own eyes feel like ice cubes. It's stupid to go so fast. I don't look at her. That easterly could knock you over the rocks. Don't be ridiculous. I'm an excellent flyer. She's right. My wife can shapeshift midair much more smoothly than I ever could, even back in the 1850s when I used to transmute into a bat 2 or 3 times a night. My metamorphosis was a shy and halting process. Look, she says, triumphant, mocking, you're still trembling. I look down at my hands, very angry to realize it's true. McGreb roots through the tall black blades of grass. It's late, Clyde. Where's my lemon? I pluck a soft round lemon from the grass, a summer moon, and hand it to her. This Verdelli I have chosen is perfect, flawless. She looks at it with distaste and makes a big show of brushing off a marching ribbon of ants. A toast, I say. A toast, my wife replies, with the rote enthusiasm of Christians saying grace. We lift the lemons and swing them to our faces. We plunge our fangs, piercing the skin, and emit a long, united hiss. Over the years, my wife and I have tried everything. Fangs in apples, fangs in rubber balls. We have lived everywhere. Tunis, Laos, Cincinnati, Salamanca. We spent our honeymoon hopping continents, hunting liquid chimeras, mint tea in Fez, coconut slurries in Oahu, jet black coffee in Bogota, jackal's milk in Dakar, cherry coke floats in rural Alabama. 1,000 beverages purported to have magical quenching properties. We went thirsty in every region of the globe before finding our oasis here in the blue boot of Italy at this dead nun's lemonade stand. It is only these lemons that give us any relief. When we first landed in Sorrento, I was skeptical. The pitcher of lemonade we ordered looked cloudy and adulterated, sugar clumped at the bottom. I took a gulp, and a whole small lemon lodged in my mouth. And there is no word lovely enough for the first taste, the first feeling of my fangs in that lemon. It was bracingly sour, with a delicate hint of ocean salt. After an initial prickling, a sort of chemical effervescence along my gum line. A soothing blankness traveled from the tip of each fang to my fevered brain. These lemons are a vampire's analgesic. If you have been thirsty for a long time, if you have been suffering, then the absence of those two feelings, however brief, becomes a kind of heaven. I breathe deeply through my nostrils. my throbbing fangs were still. By daybreak, the numbness had begun to wear off. These lemons relieve our thirst without ending it, like a drink we can hold in our mouths but never swallow. Eventually, the original hunger returns. I have tried to be very good, very correct and conscientious about not confusing this original hunger with the thing I feel for my wife. I cannot joke about my early years on the blood, can't even think about them without guilt and acidic embarrassment. Unlike my wife, who has never had a sip of the stuff, I listened to the village gossips and believed every rumor, internalized every report of corrupted bodies, boiled blood. Vampires were the favorite undead of the Enlightenment, and as a young boy, I aped the diction and mannerisms I read about in books. Vlad the Impaler, Count Heinrich the Despoiler, Goethe's blood-sucking bride of Corinth. I eavesdropped on the terrified prayers of an old woman in a cemetery, begging God to protect her from me. I felt a dislocation then, a spreading numbness, as if I were invisible or already dead. After that, I did only what the story suggested, beginning with that old woman's blood. I slept in coffins, in black cedar boxes, and woke every night with a fierce headache. I was famished, perennially dizzy. I had unspeakable dreams about the sun. In practice, I was no suave viscount, just a teenager in a red velvet cape, awkward and voracious. I wanted to touch the edges of my life, the same instinct, I think, that inspires your mortals to flip tractors and enlist in foreign wars. One night I skulked into a late mass with a vague plan to defeat eternity. At the back of the nave, I tossed my mousy curls, rolled my eyes heavenward, and plunged my entire arm into a bronze pail of holy water. Death would be painful, I thought, but I did not care about pain. I wanted to overturn my sentence. It was working. I could feel the burn beginning to spread. Actually, it was more like an itch. But I was sure the burning would start any second. I slid into a pew, snug in my misery, and waited for my body to turn to ash. By sunrise, I developed a rash between my eyebrows, a little late flowering acne, but was otherwise fine, and I understood I truly was immortal. At that moment, I yielded all discrimination. I bit anyone kind or slow enough to let me get close. Men, women, even some of the older boys and girls, the littlest children I left alone, very proud at the time of this one scruple. I'd read stories about Hungarian vampires who drank the blood of orphan girls, and I mentioned this to my wife early on, hoping to impress her with my decency. "Not children," she wept. She wept for a day and a half. Our first date was in Cementerio de Colón, if I can call a chance meeting between headstones a date. I have this problem a lot. It's a wild west, isn't it? What is a date? No one knows anymore. I had been stalking her, following her swishing hips as she took a shortcut through the cemetery grass. She wore her hair in a low, snaky braid that was coming unraveled. When I was near enough to touch her trailing ribbon, she whipped around. "Are you following me?" She sounded annoyed, not scared. My face she regarded with the contempt of a woman confronting the town drunk. "Oh," she said, "your teeth." And then she grinned. Magreb was the first and only other vampire I've ever met. We bared our fangs over a tombstone and we recognized each other. There is a loneliness that must be particular to monsters, I think, the feeling that each is the only child of a species. And now that loneliness was over. Our first date lasted all night. Magreb's talk seemed to lunge forward like a train without a conductor. I suspect even she didn't know what she was saying. I certainly wasn't paying attention. And then I heard her ask, "So, when did you figure out that the blood does nothing?" At the time of this conversation, I was edging on 130. I had never gone a day since early childhood without drinking several pints of blood. "The blood does nothing." My forehead burned and burned. "Didn't you think it suspicious that you had a heartbeat?" she asked me, "that you had a reflection in water?" When I did not answer, Magreb went on, "Every time I saw my own face in a mirror, I knew I wasn't any of those ridiculous things, a bloodsucker, a sanguina. Sure, I said, nodding. For me, mirrors had always had the opposite effect. I saw a mouth ringed in black blood. I saw the pale sun of the villagers' fears. Those initial days with my wife nearly undid me. At first, my euphoria was sharp and blinding, all my thoughts spooling into a single blue thread of relief. The blood does nothing. I don't have to drink the blood. But when that subsided, I found I had nothing left. If we didn't have to drink the blood, then what on earth were these fangs for? Sometimes I think she preferred me then. I was like her own child, raw and amazed. We smashed my coffin with an axe and spent the night at a hotel. I lay there wide-eyed in the big bed, I lay there wide-eyed in the big bed, my heart thudding like a fishtail against the floor of a boat. You're really sure? I whispered to her. I don't have to sleep in a coffin. I don't have to sleep through the day. But she had already drifted off. A few months later, she suggested a picnic. But the sun. Maghreb shook her head. You poor thing, believing all that garbage. By this time, we'd found a dirt cellar in which to live in Western Australia, where the sun burned through the clouds like dining lace. That sun ate lakes, rising out of dead volcanoes at dawn, triple the size of the harvest moon, and skull white, a grass scorcher. You go ahead. You try to walk into that sun when you've been told your bones are tinder. I stared at the warped planks of the trapdoor above us, the copper ladder that led rung by rung to the bright world beyond. Time fell away from me then, and I was a child again, afraid, afraid. My wife rested her hand on the small of my back. You can do it, she said, nudging me gently. I took a deep breath, hunched my shoulders, my scalp grazing the cellar door, my hair soaked through with sweat. I focused my thoughts to still the tremors so that my fangs would not slice the inside of my mouth and turn my face away from Maghreb. Go on. I pushed up, felt the wood give way, light exploded through the cellar, my pupils shrank to dots. Outside, the whole world was on fire. Mute explosions rocked the scrubby forest, motes of light burning like silent rockets. The sun fell through the eucalyptus and Australian pines in bright red bars. I pulled myself out onto my belly, balled up in the soil, and I screamed for mercy until I'd exhausted myself. Then I opened one watery eye and took a long look around. The sun was not fatal. It was just uncomfortable, making my eyes itch and water and inducing a sneezing attack. After that, and for the whole of our next 30 years together, I watched the auroral colors and I waited to feel anything but terror. Fingers of light spread across the gray sea toward me, and I could not see these colors as beautiful. The sky I lived under was a hideous, lethal mix of orange and pink. By the 1950s, we were living in a Cincinnati suburb, and as the day's first light hit the kitchen windows, I'd press my face against the linoleum and gibber my terror into the cracks. So, my wife would say, I can tell you're not a morning person. Then she'd sit on the porch swing and rock with me, patting my hand. What's wrong, Clyde? I shook my head. This was a new sadness, very difficult to express. My bloodlust was undiminished, but now the blood would not fix it. It never fixed it, Maghreb reminded me, and I wished that she would please stop talking. That cluster of years was a very confusing period. Mostly I felt grateful above ground feelings. I was in love. For a vampire, my life was very normal. Instead of stalking prostitutes, I went on long bicycle rides with Maghreb. We visited botanical gardens and rode in boats. In a short time, my face had gone from lithium white to the color of milky coffee. Yet sometimes, especially at high noon, I'd study Maghreb's face with a hot, illogical hatred, each pore opening up to swallow me. Oh, you have ruined my life, I'd think. To correct for her power over my mind, I tried to fantasize about mortal women, their wild eyes and bare swan necks, and I couldn't do it, not anymore. An eternity of vague female smiles eclipsed by McGreb's tiny razor fangs, two gray tabs against her lower lip. But like I said, I was mostly happy. I was making a kind of progress. One night, children wearing necklaces of garlic bulbs arrived giggling at our door. It was Halloween, and they were vampire hunters. The smell of garlic blasted through the mail slot along with their voices. Trick or treat! In the old days, I would have cowered from these kids. I would have run downstairs to barricade myself in my coffin, but that night, I pulled on an undershirt and opened the door. I stood in a square of green light in my boxer shorts, hefting a bag of Tootsie Pops, a small victory over the old fear. "Mister, are you okay?" I blinked down at a little blonde child, and I saw that my two hands were shaking violently, soundlessly, like old friends wishing not to burden me with their troubles. I dropped the candies into the children's bags, thinking, "You small mortals do not realize the power of your stories." We were downing strawberry velvet cocktails on the Seine when something inside me changed. 30 years, 11,000 dawns. That is how long it took me to believe the sun would not kill me. "Wanna go see a museum or something? We're in Paris, after all." "Okay." We walked over a busy pedestrian bridge in a flood of light, and my heart was in my throat. Without any discussion, I understood that McGreb truly was my wife. Because I love her, my hunger pangs have gradually mellowed into a comfortable despair. Sometimes I think of us as two holes cleaved together, two twin hungers. Our bellies growl at each other like companionable dogs. I love the sound, assuring me we're equals in our thirst. We bump our fangs and feel like we're coming up against the same hard truth. Human marriages amuse me. The brevity of the commitment and all the ceremony that surrounds it. The calla lilies, the veiled mother-in-laws like lilac spiders, the tears and earnest toasts. "Till death do us part." That is easy. These mortal couples only keep each other in sight for 50, 60 years. Often I wonder to what extent a mortal's love grows from the bedrock of his or her foreknowledge of death, love coiling like a green stem out of that blankness in a way I'll never quite understand. And lately I have been having a terrible thought. Our love affair will end before the world does. One day, without any preamble, my wife flew up to the caves. She called over her furry, muscled shoulder that she just wanted to sleep for a while. "What? Wait, what's wrong?" I'd caught her mid-shift, halfway between a wife and a bet. "Don't be so sensitive, Clyde. I am just tired of this century. So very tired. Maybe it's the heat. I think I need a little rest." I assumed this was an experiment like my red cape, an old habit to which she was returning, and from the clumsy, ambivalent way she crashed around on the wind, I understood I was supposed to follow her. Well, too bad. My wife likes to say she freed me, disabused me from the old stories, but I gave up much more than I intended. I cannot shudder myself out of this old man's body. I cannot fly anymore. Fila and I are alone today. I press my dry lips together and shove dominoes around the table. They buckle like the cars of a tiny train. "More lemonade, grandfather?" she asks. She leans from her waist and boldly touches my right fang, a thin string of hanging drool. "Looks like you're thirsty." "Please," I gesture at the bench, "have a seat." Fila is 17 now, and she's known about me for some time. She's toying with the idea of telling her boss, weighing the sentence within her like a bullet in a gun. There is a vampire in our grove. "You don't believe me, Signore Alberti," she'll say, before taking him by the wrist and leading him to this bench, and I will choose that moment to rise up and bite him in his hog-thick neck. "Right through his stupid tie," Fila says with a grin. But this is just idle fantasy, she assures me. The girl is content to let me alone. "You remind me of my nono," she says approvingly. "You look very Italian." In fact, she wants to help me hide here. It gives her a warm feeling to do so, like helping her own fierce nono do up the small buttons of his trousers, a move too intricate now for his palsied hands. She worries about me, too, and she should. Lately, I've gotten sloppy, incontinent about my secrets. I've stopped polishing my shoes. I let the tip of that fang hang over my lip. You must be more careful, she reprimands. There are tourists everywhere. I study her neck as she says this, her head rolling with the natural expressiveness of a girl. She checks to see if I am watching her collarbone, and I let her see that I am. I feel like a threat again. So normally I stop right there, but I can do a jump to the end. I look to Brad for advice. I'm going to do this thing now, guys. It's kind of obnoxious, but I'll need you to trust that you've developed a feeling for this old man. There's, you know, the writing that I'm skipping, it's the most amazing prose, actually, of the whole story. Let's just assume. It's a little bread bowl scoop. So what ends up happening in the fall off the wagon, crazy heart fashion, it's like the old story we all know. This old man, desperate to feel like a threat again, ends up having a kind of an unfortunate episode with this young girl. So I'll just pick it up after that episode. I stare vacantly at a pale mole above the girl's collarbone. Maghreb, I think again, and I smile. And this smile feels like a muzzle, stretched taut against my teeth. It seems my hand has tightened on Fila's wrist, and I realize with surprise, as if from a great distance, that the girl is twisting away. Hey, no, no. Come on now. What are you doing? The girl's head lolls against my shoulder like a sleepy child's, then swings forward in a ragdoll circle. The starlight is white mercury compared to her blotted out eyes. There's a dark stain on my periwinkle shirt and one suspender has snapped. I sit Fila's body against the alley wall, watch it dim and stiffen. Spidery graffiti weaves over the brick behind her and I scan for any answer contained there. Giovanna and Fabiano, vaffanculo, vai in culo. A scabby furred creature, our only witness, arches its orange back against the dumpster. If not for the lock, I would ease the girl inside. I would climb in with her and let the red stench fill my nostrils and let flies crawl into the red corners of my eyes. I am a monster again. I ransack the girl's pockets and I find the key to the funicular office, careful not to look at her face. Then I'm walking, running for our lemon grove. I jimmy my way into the control room and I turn the silver key, relieved to hear the engine roar to life. Locked, 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 locked. Every funicular car is locked, but I find one with thick tape and X's over a busted door. I dash after it, pull myself into the cushion, quickly because the cars are already moving. Even now, after what I've done, I am still unable to fly, still imprisoned in this wretched body, reduced to using the mortal's machinery to carry me up to the caves to find my wife. The box jounces and trembles. The chain pulls me into the heavens, link by link. My lips are chapped. I stare through a crack in the glass window. The box swings wildly in the wind. The sky is a deep blue vacuum. I can still smell that girl in the folds of my clothes. The cave system at the top of our cliffs is vaster than I expected, and with their grandfather faces tucked away, the bats are anonymous as stones. I walk beneath a chandelier of furry bodies, heartbeats wrapped in wings the color of rose petals or corn silk. Breath ripples through each of them, a tiny life in its translucent envelope. Maghreb? Is she up here? Has she left me? I will never find another vampire. I double back to the moonlit entrance that leads to the open air of the cliffs, the funicular cars. When I find my wife, I will beg her to tell me what she dreams up here. I'll tell her my waking dreams in the lemon grove, the mortal men and women floating serenely by in balloons freighted with the ballast of their deaths. Millions of balloons riding over a wide ocean, lives darkening the sky, death as a dense powder cinched inside tiny sandbags, and in this dream I am given to understand that instead of a sandbag, I have Maghreb. I make the bats descend in a cable car with no wings to spread, knocked around by the wind with a force that feels personal. I struggle to hold the door shut, and I look for the green speck of our grove. The box is plunging now, far too quickly. It swings wide, and the igneous surface of the mountain fills the left window. The tufa shines like water, like a black, heat-bubbled river. For a dizzying instant, I expect the rock to seep through the glass. Each swing takes me higher than the last, a grinding pendulum that approaches a full revolution around the cable. I'm on my hands and knees on the car floor, seasick in the high air, pressing my face against the floor grate. I can see stars or boats burning there, and also a ribbon of white, a widening fissure. Air gushes through the cracks in the glass box. With a lurch of surprise, I realize that I could die. What does Maghreb see if she is watching? Is she waking from a nightmare to see the line snap, the glass box plummet? From her inverted vantage, dangling from the roof of the cave, does the car seem to be sucked upward, rushing not toward the sea, but into another sort of sky, to a black mouth open and foaming with stars? I like to picture my wife like this. Maghreb shuts her thin eyelids tighter. She digs her claws into the rock. Little clouds of dust plume around her toes as she swings upward. She feels something growing inside her, a dreadful suspicion. It is solid, this new thing. It is the opposite of hunger. She is emerging from a dream of distant thunder, rumbling and loose. Something has happened tonight that we thought impossible. In the morning, she will want to tell me all about it.